So this evening I'd like to reflect upon the quality of spaciousness. In German it is
Geräumigkeit.
We got it? I did learn how to say that earlier, but I already forgot by the time. So if you listen to this teaching for long enough, you're likely to hear this word spaciousness used quite frequently. It might even be a word that you use, and it's most likely a quality that you long for. So when I began to reflect on this quality of spaciousness, I first looked to the early tradition and what the early teachings had to say about spaciousness. And the closest term I could come to or found was an expansive mind. And it was really referring to a mind that was not identified, a mind that was not clinging. So then I began to look a little bit further at what other people had to say about spaciousness. So I did what many of us do. I thought I would look at what Google had to say about spaciousness. And first it came up with a very, very brief kind of dictionary definition about room and about vastness and about uncrowdedness. But I was more struck by some of the visual images that came up on Google, where it showed a person looking out over in Canada over these endless wheat fields that seemed to go on forever with the wind blowing the wheat. It also brought up the images of astronauts in space, looking down at the earth and how they talk about this shift in perspective from being preoccupied with the details of every moment to this much bigger sense of holding all of those details. One of the images that came up was of an ocean, that seemed to stretch on without borders, or a person on a mountainside looking down over the woods and the valleys below. And I think what was really common to many of these images was more of a felt sense of stillness, of calmness, of quietude, and of peacefulness. As I mentioned last night, one of the earliest instructions that I heard in the teaching was to find a secluded place with long views. So it's very supportive for our practice, having the kind of physical long views. Gives a clue to the mind a little bit. And I think you might have sensed this even here today. That shift from a sense of spaciousness when the air is clear and you look out over the mountains and, the view is so big and so vast. And then you feel the clouds come in, until you can only see like 2 or 3 feet in front of you. And the sense of that sense of space somehow almost just disappearing. And I think the kind of message that we can glean from this is that spaciousness is really not just about our inner environment, but it is about the inner environment of our hearts and minds in which our practice can, I think, find firm ground, find really firm roots. And this is, I think, is our greatest challenge. And I think that this quality of spaciousness is something that's really useful to reflect on as we begin a retreat, what it means to us. Is spaciousness just a state that comes and goes? Or is it a quality, like all of the other qualities in this practice, you know, like mindfulness, like kindness, like compassion, that we can actually cultivate and remember. And is this sense of spaciousness something that is actually really so vital to our practice? Not just an episodic encounter, but really as a place where we can make our home. Now, externally, we have a lot of spaciousness in place. And can we learn this internally? Learn what it means to abide and to rest in spaciousness. We can get very busy on retreats. You know, we can get very busy in the beginning of retreats. We can have all kinds of good intentions. And there seems to be a lot to do, actually. You know, here we are, we're trying to do the practice, or we're trying to stay awake, or we're trying to calm the mind, or we're trying to get connected with the body. And we can, sometimes I think people are in danger of suffering from over-earnestness, over-trying, overdoing, having too many projects, too many agendas, too many tasks to attend to. But we can get so busy, I think, with our good intentions, that we don't always step back and ask ourselves, what is the climate of our mind just now? What is our inner environment just now? Where all of those intentions and all of those efforts are arising from? Because I think if we look at that carefully, we may well discover that the shape of our mind really does become also the shape of our efforts. It is vital in this practice to really cultivate really an optimal inner environment in which our practice can really deepen. And it seems to me that struggle and unskillful effort are really the children of contractedness, of not being spacious. It also seems to me that there are lessons that are really too important for us to forget. That when there is in place good humor, goodwill, kindness, and spaciousness, the practice and our efforts come much more effortlessly. These are vital cornerstones to have in place. Now, it may be today, when you look back over the day, it may be that you have not always felt very spacious. You might even have found yourself somewhat despairing at the level of clutter in your mind. And it does become sometimes a little tedious, doesn't it? You know, the repetitive narratives. I mean, how many times do I actually need to have that thought? Huh? It can become a little bit repetitive. Or how many times do I make that trip into the museum of my past? You know, those particular memories, those particular events, those particular things that have long gone. Or how many times do I visit my future anticipations and expectations and rehearsals? And it can feel at times kind of relentless, you know, if you're awake enough to actually sense what's going on. It can feel at times somewhat relentless. And we might even try and convince ourselves that spaciousness is going to be the result of making all of this stop, or making, somehow magically making, all of that busyness go away. Or we might imagine a sort of postponed spaciousness. you know, when in a future, a hopeful moment when our life has emptied or our mind has emptied and we kind of might imagine a sort of spacious retirement. When I was a child, I used to sometimes visit my grandmother. And my grandmother had lived a very, very hard and a very difficult life as a single mother and through the war and, you know, having to support her children and, you know, quite poor. And I used to sometimes visit her, and she had learned in that very hard and difficult life, really, never to throw anything away. You know, she kept everything, because when you grow up like that, things are really precious. You know, you don't throw things away. And so her house was kind of overflowing with everything that she had collected during the whole long years of her life. And much of this was really loved by her and really reminded her, the things she collected, of, you know, all of the good times that she had had in her life. But it was also true that you could hardly move in her house. And spaciousness was not the prevailing climate. The climate of the house was a sense of crowdedness and almost claustrophobia, you know, almost of hardly being able to move without breaking something. And perhaps this is not always so different from how our mind can feel, particularly in the beginning of a retreat when we start to listen more inwardly. Now, spaciousness has a lot to do with how we incline our minds. Is that word all right to you? How you incline your mind. Incline, translation, Ursula? What you lean your mind towards. Huh? What you lean your mind towards, what you bend towards. Incline. This is a very important word in the Buddhist teaching. Spaciousness has much to do with how we incline our minds. The Buddha said that what we frequently think about and dwell upon, to this does our mind incline. That what we frequently think about and dwell upon, to this does our mind incline. Now, nature, as probably as you sense it here, has really much to teach us about learning to incline the mind toward spaciousness. When you step outside here, on a clear evening, do you actually sense the sort of vastness of the sky? Or do you find at times that the mind starts to hook on to or to latch on to, you know, a star or a cloud? When you hear a sound when we're practicing, does the attention immediately preference the sound, contract around the sound, or have a sense of the silence from which the sound emerges? John Cage was a wonderful composer. He once said, "Music is made possible by silence." If you take this reflection further, when you leave the hall after a sitting, do you find that your mind is following your eyes and your eyes are following your mind to fixate and tighten around something? Have you ever found yourself suddenly standing in front of the notice board, you know, or reviewing everybody's shoes, or, you know, fixated upon the person who's the most mindful walker in the world in front of you? Or can you pause and actually get a sense of the space that all of this is resting upon, resting in? Now, you may begin to notice that if we incline the mind towards spaciousness, rather than the contents of experience, the mind will begin to settle and to calm, and that spaciousness will begin to develop and to deepen. What the mind becomes agitated about is through fixating upon the contents of experience. The mind does not become agitated about spaciousness. Now, another word you will hear with some frequency in this practice is the word contractedness, tightness, contractedness. And it's really important, I think, to get a felt sense of what contractedness is. If you put a small stone in your open hand and then you clench your hand around that stone and make a fist, this is what contractedness is. It's a tightening, it's a closing, it's a clenching of the heart, it's a clenching of the mind. If you hold that stone in an open hand, it's not particularly unpleasant. But if you close your fist around that same stone, it certainly has the potential to be deeply uncomfortable. Now, some of this closing and tightening is quite inadvertent. It's not intentional. It's almost automatic. You know, if you were sitting here in the hall and someone suddenly out of the silence began to sing opera, or, you know, if the door slammed, or, you know, someone fell over in the dining room, your attention would be quite automatically and immediately drawn to see and to focus upon and to highlight that particular event over all others. But what would happen is that if you were really established in the practice, that when the event passed, that tightening would relax and would open. You know, there's groups of neuroscientists who love to study the brains of meditators. And one thing that they have discovered is that everybody, whether you've been practicing for 5 minutes or whether you've been practicing for 50 years, everybody has an alert, an attention alertness. You know, so if something comes into your attention field very unexpectedly, you have this attention alert that comes into being. What they found, and this might interest you or not, that with experienced meditators, that once the event had passed, the alert attentiveness would just fall away, back into a sense of stillness. With inexperienced meditators, the alertness would continue. They would go into hyper-alertness. They would go into almost this hyper-vigilance, you know, this sense of being on edge. So it wouldn't change when the event passed. It would stay there. And quite frankly, this is how people often live, is in this state of hyper-vigilance, hyper-alertness to danger, to threat, to something unexpected occurring. This is a kind of almost like a chronic contractedness. It's a chronic contractedness. Now, what we actually see is that contractedness, this chronic contractedness, is also an inclination of the mind. It's almost, we would say, a habit or a pattern of the mind. And I think that if we really treasure spaciousness, this is a habit and a pattern that we are so invited to understand. This is really the stuff of insight. Now, if we look into our own experience and these moments of tightening, these moments of contractedness, we would probably recognize that as a pattern and as a habit, contractedness always has within it some element of craving, aversion, and identification. You know, and I would invite you to look at that in your own experience. Is there ever a moment of contractedness that doesn't have in it some measure of craving or aversion or identification. Now, that pattern of tightening, as I mentioned, is, you know, there's a certain level of our attention where it's almost hardwired. It was an evolutionary survival mechanism, you know, to keep us safe. That's actually not the kind of contractedness or hyper-alertness that we're actually speaking about here. What we actually see is that the habit of contractedness is one that can change. It's not a life sentence. And that just because any pattern or any habit has a long history, it doesn't mean that it has an equally long future. Please bear that in mind when you sit there with habit patterns or tendencies that you think, oh, you know, this has been with me as long as I can remember, and almost this is who I am. You know, I'm an anxious type, or I'm a fearful type, or I'm an angry type. It doesn't necessarily have a long future. Now, I think this is really central to the teaching of mindfulness and the teaching of freedom, is to begin to spot these shifts between clenching and unclenching, between contractedness and opening. Because I suspect that you see this many, many times in a single day. Sometimes you walk into this room, and sometimes, you know, it's with a smile on your face. Other times you might walk into this room and actually think about how it needs rearranging, you know, how it can be improved, you know. Sometimes you might stand outside and look down over the valley with actually a smile in your heart. And sometimes you might stand in the same place and think, well, it'd be better if they cut down a few trees over there. The view would be improved. The Buddha said very clearly that all we are now is a result of all that we have been. And that all that we will be in the next moment, in the future, will be the result of all that we are now. Which is why this present moment recollection is so crucial. Because this is the doorway to understanding. This is the doorway to undoing patterns that do not serve us well. This is the place where habits actually can come to an end in a moment. It doesn't mean that they don't rearise or never reappear, but we learn to take away the identification with them. So, spaciousness is a training. I firmly believe this. As much as anything else is cultivated, so too is spaciousness. It's almost a resetting of the ways in which our minds incline. And we do this, we actually cultivate spaciousness in the midst of contractedness. That is, I think, just so important to recognize. Not when contractedness is over or gone away, but we learn to reset the inclination of the mind in the midst of contractedness. So part of this investigation might be looking at what it is that we actually find ourselves contracting around in a single day. And please make that reflection very real for you. You know, look back over your day. What have you contracted around today? Sometimes it's around something that is pleasant. You know, a thought about lunch. You know, and you feel the mind contract around it. Some fantasy about the future, some great plan, some delightful memory, some pleasant sound or sensation. Sometimes we contract around the unpleasant. Have you seen that? A painful sensation in the knee. You see the mind begin to clench around it. A difficult thought. A feeling of failure or unworthiness. And you can feel the field of your attention begin to shrink to the degree in which nothing else is present except that which you have contracted around. This is what is there. This becomes your reality, your moment, this difficult thought or this compelling fantasy. A friend of mine spoke after an accident, and he was left with chronic and acute pain. And he spoke about, you know, how through the practice he really learned how trackable it was what would happen in his mind in the times when the pain was the most intense. How his attention would quite naturally be drawn into that pain. But almost how that drawing in would begin to exclude everything else. So they felt that he was almost drowning in the experience of that pain. And then how rumination would follow. Why did this happen to me? You know, if only I had done things differently. Is this ever going to go away? What have I done to deserve this? And the mind and body beginning to operate in this closed feedback loop of contractedness. Then the thoughts would arise, I could never be happy as long as my body is like this. Now, can you relate to some of those closed feedback loops that happen? And that sense of contractedness and how imprisoning it can feel? That this is the total of my experience, the total of my reality. I think it is so important to really understand the impact of craving and aversion. Are those words okay for you? Anybody not get craving and aversion? At least language-wise? Craving, the endless hunger of wanting, and the aversion, the pushing away, the not wanting. And we should never underestimate the power of those impulses in our life. I mean, as human beings, we long for and we crave to have certain kinds of experiences. Pleasant experiences. Affirming experiences. And we don't want to have and are averse to have other kinds of experiences. Unpleasant, difficult experiences. We want to be the kind of person whose body is always well, you know, who ages gracefully and who dies like just fading into the sunset, you know. We want to be the kind of person whose work is always satisfying and who gets praised for everything they do, whose children thrive, you know, who is loved and admired by all and who always has good meditations, you know. And, you know, that kind of craving is like deeply central to the kind of view of self we form, isn't it? Like if I can be that kind of person and have those experiences I crave for, I will be, you know, I will be the person, I will be a good self. You know, I'm going to be a successful self. I'm going to be an admired self. We certainly don't want to be the kind of person whose children struggle and fail, who gets ill, who's afraid, who has an uncooperative mind, who has endlessly disappointing meditations. And part of this is kind of like very human, isn't it? It's part of this is kind of very understandable. But when we find ourselves being that kind of person or identified with being that kind of person, it seems to construct a terrible self, doesn't it? A self who's a failure, a self who's not good enough, you know, whose self is not as good as others. Now, part of this is human, part of this is understandable, but have you noticed the way that craving and aversion start to harden? And they become almost demands. They become a kind of insistence. You know, this is how I have to be. This is how life has to be. This is how you have to be. And this is how life can't be. This is how I can't be. And this is how you can't be. And that craving and aversion that's happening inwardly patterns our behavior, doesn't it? If I feel really averse to something, to any kind of experience, I'm going to run from it. You know, if I really feel that I have to have a certain kind of experience and become a certain kind of person, all of my behavior is going to be directed towards that achievement. And we don't always actually see the way that these very deeply embedded patterns are implicated in the painful contractedness that we experience. The more craving and aversion that is happening, the more narrative and story will be happening. The more judgment will be happening. The more comparing will be happening. The more agitation will be happening. And I do invite you to check this out in your own experience. You know, please don't just think, oh, she says it, it's a good idea. You know, she's talking about somebody else. You know, I really do invite you to check this out in your own experience. And our views of self become very rigid and very fixed. And much of our life can be filled with the busyness of trying to make our cravings and aversions work. You notice that? Trying to make our cravings and aversions work. We become preoccupied with the contents of our experience. And we see the tendency of the mind then to seize upon a small fragment of experience and mistake it to be the whole. It's worthwhile to see how frequently this operates in a single day. You know, maybe today you've had somebody, you've gone to your walking path. It's already yours. You've only been here 5 minutes, but it's already my walking path. And somebody else is on it. And the thought arises, you know, well, this has to be the most inconsiderate meditator in the entire world. There they are on my walking path. You might leave the retreat and not see that person again for 10 years. You see them again. There is that most inconsiderate meditator who was ever born. And what we have done is actually we've seized upon a fragment of experience, haven't we? And mistaken it to be the whole. Mistaken it to be the whole of that person. We see how we do this with ourselves. You know, a sitting that doesn't go well, or, you know, a very vengeful thought arises. You know, or a very greedy thought arises. And we seize upon it, identify with it, and this is who I am. Suddenly this is who I am. This is the whole of my being. This teaching often, encourages us to reflect upon these moments, not as a way of making ourselves feel worse already, but as a way of understanding what it is to find freedom from craving and aversion. Especially, and that freedom from craving and aversion really rests upon really a considerable amount of understanding and insight. It's not just about being more mindful or about being more slow. It's about understanding actually what's going on. Because spaciousness is not about this endless search to rearrange the conditions of our lives. But it's really understanding the way that we hold those conditions. Spaciousness is not a state. It's a way of being that rests upon really a considerable shift in view that allows us to embrace the world of conditions without fear and without craving and without aversion. The freedom to step out of craving and aversion really rests upon understanding in our bones, really understanding in our bones that yes, there is much in life that is lovely. There is much in life that is really difficult. We're not in control of those conditions. You cannot get up this morning and decide that the sun will shine all day. You know? There's so much that we are not in control of. But it's truly understanding that genuine, enduring happiness and joy is actually born within. Craving and aversion only can operate as long as we hold the view that this event or this experience or this thing or this taste or this sight or this sound holds the intrinsic power to make me happy. Aversion can only exist as long as we hold the view that this event or this sight or this person holds the intrinsic power to make me unhappy. This is the insight where the Buddha really began this teaching. To understand in our bones that the source of genuine and enduring happiness is actually within our own minds and hearts that abide in understanding how things actually are. Contractedness comes to an end when we don't any longer seize upon fragments of experience and mistake them to be a whole. Contractedness comes to an end when we deeply, deeply sense the fluid, unfolding, changing nature of all things, when we learn that we cannot actually define ourselves by the contents of our own minds or our own experience. And that is quite a big one. That you cannot be defined by the contents of your mind. A difficult thought does not make you a terrible person. A difficult falling asleep in meditation does not make you a failed meditator. Having a difficult emotion does not make you an unworthy person. It's really realizing that you cannot be defined by the contents of your mind, that what actually happens in that definition is you form a view of who you are. And it is only a view. And that as much as the world is fluid and unfolding and dynamic, so too are we as human beings. And that fluid, dynamic, unfolding person who we are and have the potential to be is only interrupted by the contractedness that is born of identification. And identification begins with craving and aversion. Identification is only an intensification of craving and aversion. We learn to allow the mind and the world to be as it is, and then the mind can begin to still. This does not mean that the world does not need our efforts or our wise responses or our care or our compassion, but this is not born of agitation. All of that is not born of agitation. It is born of stillness and spaciousness. When we get caught in the world of contractedness, we start to believe that something has to go away in order for spaciousness to be found. And then we tend to polarize spaciousness and contractedness. Rather than recognizing that contractedness is actually a moment of forgetfulness. It's a moment of forgetfulness. And we learn to remember. You know, over the last year, I've been reflecting a lot upon what peaceful coexistence means. What that means in our experience, a peaceful coexistence. And I'll read you a story which is quite a dramatic illustration of this. This was written by a mother whose 3-year-old daughter had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. She says, it was right then that it happened. It was such a strange and glorious thing that if I hadn't experienced it myself, I wouldn't have believed it was possible. I forgot for a moment that Hannah was sick. I wasn't even aware of having forgotten. It was as if I had been sucked out of the story of cancer, treatment, worry, and death. Hannah was playing in the dirt, and I was sitting with a friend. It was a moment of nothing special, of nothing going on. In a flash, whatever had sucked me up spit me out again. Even so, something felt different, although I again remembered that Hannah was sick. Some part of the stillness remained. Later I sat on the front porch in the residue of that stillness, peeling away the layers of night sky. And the night sky was like my life, each layer a level of experience. No element or moment of it was more or less, better or worse than any other. Each was an offering to the whole, in its suspended, inky stillness. Now, our understanding, I think, of peaceful coexistence is unlikely to be as dramatic as this. This is turning into a long talk. I'm sorry. But I want you to get a sense of what peaceful coexistence might be for you just now. There are parts of your body that might hurt, and you can sense the possibility of contracting and tightening around those parts of your body. But you might also bring forward the intention to also notice the parts of your body that are quite well right now. The palm of your hand, the back of your neck. We may have difficulties in our life, difficulties in our minds. And yet still we walk and we see the sun shining and we hear the birds singing. We see the way that the flowers grow alongside the weeds. Our intention may be drawn into the busyness of a story. And yet we can also foster the intention to feel the touch of our foot on the ground. We may be filled with regrets and sorrow over all that we have left, lost. And we can also turn our attention to the gratefulness of all that we have received just now. We learn to widen the field of our attention and our intention and develop the kind of awareness that actually sees there is coexistence everywhere. There is sounds and silence. There's movement and stillness. There's effort and effortlessness. And it's something of a rotation in consciousness where we begin to rest in the seeing rather than solely in the contents of what we see. We learn to rest in the hearing rather than tightening around the sound. And coexistence is a simple truth. We all know this. But for it to be a peaceful coexistence is something different. And for it to be a peaceful coexistence really relies upon the calming and the quieting of the impulses of craving and aversion, which will always create only a very partial view and will be responsible for the contractedness. Now, this is a very practical exploration. Because we see and we feel the impulses of craving and aversion arise. We see the movement towards, to pursue. We see the pushing away. We see the impulses arise. It's almost like a reflex. But instead of following those impulses, we learn to pause. Just for a moment. Just to pause. And to feel how those impulses are really the beginnings of the contractedness. We learn to, we don't need to fill the space of every moment with our narrative and busyness. We learn we can begin to calm the habit patterns. When we calm the habit patterns of craving and aversion, we calm the habit pattern of identification, which is what we contract around. And we hear the story of that contractedness. This is me. This is my pain. This is my terrible thought. This is my story. We hear the narrative of the contractedness that leads us to inhabit some very closed rooms. Spaciousness, I think, it is a practice of happiness. It's a practice of ease. It's a practice of wakefulness. And the cultivation of spaciousness, I think, is both the kindergarten and the graduate school of this practice. It's what frees us rather than from judgment and blame. And I think we need to get interested in the landscape of contractedness. Listen inwardly to the moments when your body begins to tighten, you know, to the moments when you start to highlight a particular thought pattern, the moments when you begin to exclude other things, the moments when the narrative begins to grow and the judgment begins to grow. Really to explore that landscape of contractedness, to be interested in it, is the beginning of developing spaciousness. And I think this is a very experiential investigation. Sensing when the tightening is happening and knowing that that which tightens can also soften. That which contracts can also open. It's a very moment-to-moment practice. There are two primary factors, I think, in the cultivation of spaciousness. Clearly the first of these is mindfulness. We have to, we need the sensitivity, the inner attunement, the inner listening to begin to sense when this closing and tightening is happening for it to begin to be able to open. But the other aspect of spaciousness is intention. And mindfulness and intention go so closely together. To have the intention of that knowing really we can choose where our attention is going to dwell. Whether it's going to dwell in contractedness or whether we're going to incline the mind to noticing the spaciousness around the contractedness. This is a moment-to-moment practice. I want to end just with a brief story. There was a hermit who was well known as an enlightened person, and he came to a heartfelt decision that he was not, in fact, fully liberated. And he thought the Buddha's teaching would help him, and he traveled across India until he reached the Buddha's center and asked to see the Buddha. "He's on his begging round," he was told. "Wait here and rest, and you'll see him soon." "I can't wait," answered the hermit. "Show me the way and I'll find him." He set off for the city center. And there he saw the Buddha going with his begging bowl from house to house. And the hermit fell to his knees and embraced the Buddha's feet. He says, "You are liberated," he said to the Buddha. "Please teach me a practice that will bring liberation." "Gladly," said the Buddha, "but not here. This is not the time or the place. Go back to my center and wait for me." "No, I can't wait. In such a short time, I might die or you might die. Now, sir, this is the time. Please teach me now." The Buddha looked at him and saw his urgency. And he realized it was a gift of compassion to offer this teaching. And he said it very simply. "In your seeing," he said, "there is only the seeing. In your hearing, there is only the hearing. In your smelling, tasting, touching, nothing but the smelling, tasting, and touching. In your thinking, there is only the thinking."